Good afternoon. The House Education Finance Committee will come to order. Welcome, everyone. Before we get to any of the testimony on the topics today, we have a number of special guests. So we're going to start off by recognizing them. First, we want to welcome Representative Wills back. She's back with us this week and has who I hope will be a frequent visitor, although you're sitting far too far away from the chair. Just...
You had him yesterday.
I did have him yesterday, but I had to give him back. But anyway, really good to see you. And do you want to introduce the new member of your family who's here with us?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Gideon. So it's my first child, and he was born February 4th, and we're excited to have him here. And he slept through the first two committees today, and now he's wide awake, so
nice. Okay.
Well, it might be a little noisy.
I think it's because he finds education more interesting than tax committee, where he was asleep the whole time, I did notice.
Conformity discussion.
Yes, tax conformity is riveting, but, you know. We're glad he's here. Thank you very much. Good to see you. And we have some terrific visitors from various high schools around the state with us. FCCLA Shadows are here today. And I know I just met with Courtney from Fulda, and several members have students here from their district. So I'm going to ask you all to stand up and then in a nice loud voice give us your name and where you're from. And should we just start with you right there?
Hi, I'm Sheridan, and I'm from
Waleka
High School.
I'm Jacob.
She's mine.
I'm Jacob Justin from Morris.
I'm McKenna Larson, and I'm from Wheaton.
I'm Rebecca Baker, and I'm from Goodhue.
And I'm Courtney Hepler, and I'm from Fulda.
And I'm Allison from Hinkley.
Excellent. Well, thank you all. It's so great to be here. Okay, personal sharing time, but FCCLA, which is a wonderful organization. The precursor to that, about 100 years ago, was Future Homemakers of America. And I was an FHA member. In fact, I was a state officer. And if anyone produces a picture, the chair will be very embarrassed from those days. But a great organization, and very glad to have you all here. So thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate it. So, all right.
Madam Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Did you win the Betty Crocker Award?
No. I did not. But, well, one other funny story going along with that. And I just wish my mother was here right now to hear this. She, and nothing's happened to her. She's just in Arizona right now. But she, there was a pie baking contest sponsored by the FHA. And I remember it very clearly because it was during a basketball game. And during halftime, they would announce the winners. And I tried really hard. I bet I tried. I made three different pies, and none of them were great. So my mother took pity on me and rolled out a pie and took it in. It was still warm, this apple pie, and stuck my name on it. And oh. Guess who won? And so it was a cookbook, and I did give her the cookbook, just so you all know. I did not keep those ill-gotten gains. And that's more than you need to hear about me today.
The chair of the Ethics Committee is sitting
here. I know. Well, which is why I made clear to say I did not keep the cookbook, and I did make it clear that my mother made the pie. So, anyway. All right, so welcome. I think, do we have enough? We have enough for quorum. So, Representative Christensen, if you would like to move adoption of the minutes from the March 17th, 2016 meeting.
Madam Chair, I move the minutes.
All right. Any questions or comments? If not, all in favor of adopting the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are approved. Thank you very much, Representative Christensen. And, all right, so today we're going to do a couple of things. First, we're going to talk about, we don't have a specific bill or proposal, but a situation that Representative Preacher brought to our attention on shared time revenue. And so we agreed that we would hear sort of the situation that has come up affecting the Pierce School District in committee today. And Representative Krisha, if you want to just kind of frame the issue and what the particular dilemma is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And committee members, what you have in front of you is what I'm hoping to prevent, a legislative situation that we just, you know, so often we hear a story from our districts that we respond with some piece of legislation and then we end up fighting about it amongst the whole state. And what I have here is I have a school district, Pierce School District, as well as Holy Trinity School District, which are, I believe, a block and a half or two blocks apart. And they are trying to share resources in a way to offer services to kids, and they've always had a very good relationship. What they've run into was a situation around shared time revenue, and quite honestly, I'm not as familiar with all the in and outs of the shared time revenue that I'd like to be, but MDE, rightly so, has made an interpretation on that, which, as you can imagine, is differs a bit from the intentions in what the Pierce School District and Holy Trinity are trying to do. And what they're really trying to do is come to a memorandum of understanding. They're just trying to make this work for their kids. I fully respect where MDE is, and they have to make interpretations, they have to make rulings. So what I'm doing here, and I hope will be helpful, and it's unique to my time, is I'm bringing them in front of the committee first. And let's talk about that. Let's hear about it as committee members. As many of us have rule. And what I'd like to know is at the end of this, can we come to something that works for both sides? If I have to offer some legislation that we could all agree on, I'd be more than happy to do it. What I would really like is if MDE and the school districts could come together and say, how about we do something that grandfathers us for a year until we figure out the right approach? So what I'm hoping is we hear from all the parties today, and rather than just throw a piece of legislation and hope it sticks against the wall, let's see if we can come to something to help both sides here. So, Madam Chair, that's what I'm hoping for today.
Thank you, Representative Crescia. And with that, I know you have Mr. Weber, Superintendent of Pierce School District, who is here. And if you want to go ahead and come to the testifier table.
Madam Chair, he used to be my superintendent, so I'm going to lay claim to him first.
Very well. Very well.
Thank you.
All right. And I understand you're...
I'm Deborah Meyer-Myrum, and I'm the administrator at Holy Trinity School District.
Very good. Well, welcome to you both.
And she used to be mine, too.
So we're very glad to have you both here, and whoever would like to lead off, if you just introduce yourself for the record before providing your testimony. And if you could, you know, members may not be, you know, all familiar with kind of the situation that's bringing you before the committee to have this discussion today, so you just give a little background information for us as part of your remarks, that would be very helpful. Okay. Welcome.
Well, my name is George Weber, and I am the proud superintendent of Pierce School District. We have a very, very, very good thing going on in Pierce, and I'm proud of my representation as well. And I appreciate your time here. From a purely statewide perspective, shared time is a very, very teeny, teeny, teeny slice, which is probably why it doesn't get a lot of attention, and maybe why some of the definitions of this aren't real clear. I think the whole state appropriation, Mr. Melcher is here, must be about $3 million. Total or something like that. So it's hardly anything and probably doesn't get a lot of legislative oversight and doesn't really need to. And what it really comes down to is students that aren't full-time students in the public school system that are somehow getting some services from public school teachers. And the example would be for us, Holy Trinity is a K-6 private school located in a school district. It's the only one. All of their children eventually go to our 712 public school. In our circumstance, and it's probably an event that happens almost only in outstate rural Minnesota, which is why it's such a small amount of money, but it's really pragmatic in really small towns. For one of the examples we're going to use is our band. So we have an elementary band, fifth grade and sixth grade band, and our total fifth grade numbers, if you combine them, are probably about 100 children. And of those, maybe 50 are in band, which is great. So we have one fifth grade band. You know, it's not like we would have a different band for Holy Trinity than we do for our public elementary school. And we have one band teacher who teaches elementary band. And we were, I guess, the lucky recipients of a Mars audit this year. And that's what brought it to light. And these are events that don't happen very often either. I don't know the last time. Have we ever had one? Once? And Earl's been there a long time. I've been there a decade, and I've not had a Mars audit. So it wouldn't even have been brought to light had that event not happened. And the auditor claimed that we couldn't give band lessons to the children of Holy Trinity Schools at Holy Trinity Schools. they said that, and so they're asking us to, or they're going to penalize us about $50,000 in revenue that we've generated through shared time. And it's not really a money-making event, because the only way you generate the revenue is we have to account for that sliver of the day that that child is getting services from a public school employee, and then count all those hours in the year, and then sort of prorate that against the gen ed aid for that particular child. So if you think of it, that child is 0.001 something public school student for that year. That's kind of how it, that's what generates the money, and that's how the formula works. But the statute on why you can't provide services in the private setting is kind of vague, and says that it says that core curriculum can't be provided in the public setting or in the private setting. And so our thinking, you know, having done this for years, is that sending the band teacher over there to give lessons to a fifth grader is not core curriculum. But MDE's interpretation is that it is, and that we have to pay a penalty for any of the money we've generated from doing this over the years. So that's kind of our concern. That's what, you know, Deb and I thought, well, how are we going to do this next year? Are we going to bus? And we were doing FIED as well. So we would send a teacher over there a couple hours a day to teach K-6 FIED. And, I mean, the alternative would be we bundle kindergartners up and bus them over, as opposed to us sending a teacher over there. It just seems more pragmatic for us to send the teacher to serve children than to try to drive children over, especially in a setting where those children wouldn't get those services in a very small private school. I understand the potential statewide implications, and I kind of get that as a big picture. But for outstate Minnesota, it just is a logical way, and it's worked. And I just don't understand really why, like Mr. Cresha mentioned, there can't be some sort of looking at it, some sort of MOU, some sort of saying, okay, let's evaluate our interpretation of core curriculum and see how it applies, especially on behalf of the children of outstate Minnesota.
Thank you. Thank you. I think Representative Cresha had a question.
Madam Chair, and I just want to, and thank you for that, Superintendent Weber, and I want to add a little bit of context there. We have a parochial school that's two blocks away, an administrator sitting next to a private school superintendent. They've worked this out. They're two blocks away. They made the decision that to move a teacher versus 30 kids is much better, less disruptive, and is working. And that's what they're asking for. So I wanted to highlight that, because when I first heard that, I mean, here we have educators doing exactly what we asked them to do, which is find out the best delivery method for these students and make it fit. And so I'm hoping that we don't make the system put a square peg in a round hole. So I wanted to add that context, because that's what you added to me in the first conversations we had. So if I want to just keep going from there.
And Representative Cresha, I'd like to add to that. We actually have 165 K-6 students. And so you'd be actually transporting that many students back and forth twice a week for physical education classes. And I'm not even sure that the district will have room to service all of, because we take two full days for FIED. And I'm not sure that they'll even have room in their facility for that. And that creates a lot more conflict going on in your setting also. So I know we kind of talked also about, well, maybe the district can rent the space from us, but we're not even sure if that's allowed.
And if you think about how elementary FIED happens, like in our school, it's part of a specialist program that's about 25 minutes long.
Right.
I mean, by the time you bundle the kindergartners up and drive them over for 20 minutes and then drive them back again, it just, it's such a disruption to the day. It's so much cleaner for us to send a teacher there and get it over with in a day, you know. So,
Another question, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just trying to think through, particularly with the band lessons, kind of what are the pieces here. So, I assume when you say band lessons, it's group performance. There may be some individual instrument instruction, but it's a group performance thing.
The band actually is, they come to the private school for the small group lessons, okay. And that's once a week. And their band, they actually are picked up and brought over to the public school for the large group instruction. with, along with the public school students. So it's very minute. The band is a very minute piece. So what's happening?
Representative Dabney.
So, Madam Chair, it sounds like it's a hybrid situation with the band students getting some of their training at your school and some at the public. Okay.
Mr.
So,
Chair.
I'm sorry.
Correct? Did you say correct?
Yes, correct.
Thank you. All right.
Yes.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Air Traffic Controller. So the concern I was spinning around and wanting to land on is who's making the decision in terms of the music being performed, and just wanting to avoid any sort of church-state conflict there. But it sounds so. Why don't you tell me who makes the decision as to what music is performed, and does it, you know?
We have an elementary band teacher.
Mr.
Pass,
Weber.
Pass muster.
Okay, Mr. Weber. And we make the choice. The kids are part of our band, okay? And so we have the band room. They don't have a band room. And so for the actual large group band, which is twice a week, we do transport the children over fifth grade band. But then the lesson model, we don't have band as a class. So even in our school, for children to get their private lessons or individual time or group time, we pull them out of a class sometime during the day. And so that's what we do at Holy Trinity. We send the teacher over there, and then those teachers excuse those children kind of in a rotationary basis once a week or twice a week to get their lessons. So that's what we're doing.
Representative Dabney?
Music selection is completely public schools.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wondered if Mr. Melcher could come to the testifying table and explain this vagueness in the definition. You know, is it an interpretation by the department, or is it an error that we have made?
Thank you. And welcome, Mr. Melcher, if you just introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Tom Melcher, and I'm the Director of Finance at the Department of Education. So we've had the shared time law on the books for many years, and the shared time law does specify that with the exception of special education and English language learning services and title services, that shared time aid is paid for core instruction services provided at the public school, cannot be funded at the private school. Unfortunately, we don't have a definition of core curriculum in statute. Core curriculum is also used in the Minnesota Education Credit Statute, where parents can be reimbursed for a certain portion of the cost of providing supplemental instruction outside of the regular school day, and that references core curriculum as well. But there are also other references in that law which make it a bit confusing. So there are department interpretations of what core curriculum is that go back for 35 years, and the department has pretty consistently said that if it's a program that's offered for credit or required for graduation or contributes toward grade progression, something during the core school day, that's considered to be part of the core curriculum. And the department, the MARS manual, MARS is the student accounting manual for school districts, spells that out. But it's not an area that's trained heavily because it is a very small program, $3.5 million a year. So, quite frankly, our student accounting specialists, when they're training, they're spending a lot more time on what we're doing with the $7 billion of money that's going out through the general education formula than we are with the shared time piece. So it's very understandable that there may not be complete understanding, especially if there are practices that have developed over the years. We do 25 audits a year by state law. We go out and audit the MARS data, the student accounting data, and we happen to have had an audit in December in Pierce. The preliminary report actually just came out yesterday. The school district will have time to appeal the report, and the commissioner will ultimately make a ruling if the school district appeals. And this morning was the first time that I had heard that part of the band program was provided at the public school and part was provided at the private school. So I'm guessing that on appeal the commissioner would consider that part of that's at the public school and take that into account. So it may be that the audit findings would be a little bit smaller in this circumstance. But the area of physical education and music are included in the definition of areas that we have required academic accountability for. That includes language arts, math, science, social studies, physical education, health, and the arts. So those, you know, there are some documents in statute that kind of refer to physical education and arts programs as being part of the broad curriculum of schools, and that would be consistent with our interpretation. If we were to change state law to say that physical education classes provided by public school teachers at private schools were fundable by the state, there would be a significant fiscal impact on the state budget. So we've got a very kind of small situation here, but I think in part that's driven by the fact that we've provided this guidance over the last 35 years, indicating that that's not an allowable thing to do. So we're sympathetic with the school situation, but our past history is that we would not allow instruction in physical education or in music to be provided at a private school.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Melcher, and I don't want you to tell me school district, but have there been other situations in which the audit has revealed this similar occurrence that's happening between Holy Trinity and Piers Public?
Madam Chair, Mr. and Representative Melcher. Erickson, I haven't reviewed that specifically, but I can't recall one. And if there are a relatively small number of school districts that I think you have a list of the school districts that have shared time, and they're relatively small programs. And to my knowledge, most of those non-special education students are in fact going to the public school to take some form of instruction. But to my knowledge, we have not had a finding like this before.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. And Mr. Melcher, just a question. So, In sort of coming up with these guidelines or procedures, is it as formal as rulemaking or regulations that the department has undergone and trying to, you know, put some definitions around this, or is it a little less formal than that?
I think it's probably less formal, Madam Chair. This has been going on for at least 35 years, and so we get inquiries from school districts. We try to provide clarification. Sometimes we check with legislative staff as to intent. I know when I talk to our student accounting person who works on the MARS manual, she said, well, you know, the last time we took a close look at this was in the 90s when the state had something called the profiles of learning, and at that time we said if it was one of the subjects that was included in that, there were 10 areas, it was considered a core academic program, and physical education and music were part of that, is my understanding, and so that was included. We haven't really spent a lot of time reviewing those things. It's just kind of been carried forward year after year, and we do provide a lot of accounting guidance to school districts in terms of exactly how to report their student information, and so it's just been department administrators trying to carry out what the law means.
Thank you. I have a couple of other members with questions on the list. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Melcher, does this extend also to homeschooled students? Can they also avail themselves, say, of a music class or physical education class?
Madam Chair
and Representative Newton, I believe that homeschooled students are considered non-public school students, and if they want to enroll at a class at a public school building, they can do that, and they would be counted as a shared time student. And the shared time funding is based on the general education formula allowance multiplied by the percentage of the day that student is enrolled in the public school building taking a class, and then we apply the pupil unit weighting if it's a secondary student, the 1.2. Recently, the largest issue we've had with this program has involved online programs, and specifically homeschool students that wanted to take online programs, and the ruling that that we've been following is that homeschool students are not allowed to take online programs unless they come to the public school building to take them, because the law specifies that they can only be courses that are offered at the public school. So that's another area. If you get into the issue of shared time and what should be defined to include that, this online becomes kind of a breaking area where things are a little bit less defined than they have been in the past.
I've got Representative Newton follow-up.
Yes, no, thank you. That's very good. Thank you.
Okay, and I'm sorry, members, I've got a few folks on the list. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Talking about a fifth grade student taking a clarinet lesson, to me, doesn't conjure up the idea of core curriculum. So at least when we were in school years and years ago, band wasn't required. So does that make any difference if a course, in this case a music lesson, is not a required course? It's an optional course?
Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative, the department interpretation of at this time and what's in our student accounting manual essentially says if you get credit for it, if it's a high school class, you get credit toward graduation, or if it's in the elementary school, if it's part of the core day, it's not something you come in before school or stay after school to take, then, you know, it doesn't matter if you've got some elective classes. You couldn't offer elective classes and have a public school teacher go, you know, like, for example, you know, fourth year French might be an elective class, but you couldn't say, well, the public school teacher can teach electives at the private school, but not required courses.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you. Mr. Melcher, could you explain then what happens if you find an error, or if the audit finds an error? Who paid? Is there a penalty, or is there an exchange of monies, or a bill sent, or what?
Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, as I indicated, under state law, the department is required to perform 25 audits of data that's used to drive state aids each year. And we primarily focus on data that's provided to the department that drives our general education aid, which is where most of the money is. So typically we're auditing average daily membership, we're auditing whether a student was actually qualified for free and reduced lunch in order to get compensatory revenue. Those are the main areas we look at. So if the auditors go out and have findings, and we have three auditors that are full-time that do this work, they will have an exit conference with the school district before they go, and they will say, here's our preliminary findings, and give the school district an opportunity to talk about those with them. Then they'll come back to the department and write up their findings. They'll turn it over to my staff, who calculate, you know, if we're going to take away, you know, four students in average daily membership, or we're going to take away, in this case, 147 students were involved part-time in shared time programs. We'll figure out what that amounts to on a full-time equivalent basis. Then we will recalculate the state aid based on what they would have received if the student accounting had been reported the way the auditors say that it should be. And then we will include that state aid adjustment in a letter to the school district. In this case, the letter was finished yesterday, and send it out to the school district. I spoke with Mr. Weberly, and he has not received the report. It's in the mail. But at any event, they will get that report, and then they have a certain number of days from yesterday to appeal. And they can appeal, if they want, to the Commissioner of Education. And the Commissioner will review that. We have an appeals team in the department. There are three or four of us, depending on what area is being audited, that will sit on an appeals committee, and we will review the appeal. So in this case, the school district, I'm not going to put words in their mouth, but they could say, well, you took away money for band, but really some of that band was at the public school. And that's not reflected in the audit report, so we don't think it's fair to take that money away for those kids that were in the band class. So they could appeal that, provide us with documentation. The appeal committee would look at that, and then we would make a recommendation to the commissioner as to whether to approve all or part of the appeal. Once the commissioner makes a final ruling, then we would adjust the current year state aid to reflect the audit findings. So in this case, the auditors are recommending that we reduce the state aid to the Pierce School District by $52,000. So if the all of the audit findings were upheld, then probably a couple months from now, the school district would be seeing a negative $52,000 adjustment on one of their general education aid payments.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Mr. Melcher, then in their appeal, do they get to talk about the deficit that's put in with the band, having that many students in the band, and then all of a sudden saying that many students can't be in the band, and then what's left of the band isn't so much, and their tunes wouldn't be so great.
Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, I haven't seen an appeal that would go to that along that line of argument. Certainly they can put whatever they want in the appeal, but in terms of what the appeals committee will look at, they will, for example, there might be some information the auditors didn't know about. So it's not uncommon. We do a lot of compensatory audits, and one of the common findings is the district couldn't produce the document that verified that the student's family income was below the level which causes them to be eligible for free and reduced lunch. And so maybe the district says, well, you know, that file box was in the storeroom and we couldn't find it. We now have it. Here's the document. So they could produce that on appeal. And we would say, yep, we looked at it. It's got original signatures on it. The date's okay. And we would give them the money back for that sort of situation. In this situation, the appeal would probably be based on facts that are in the audit report that they would dispute. They can't appeal and say, gee, if we lose $52,000, we're going to be an SOD or some other kind of reason. It just has to be based on the facts of the audit and whether they have some new information that would cause the auditors to change their mind or the commissioner on appeal to change her mind. So the commissioner could say, well, gee, you know, that MARS manual is outdated and it needs to be revised or something like that. That would be pretty extraordinary, though. Typically, the auditors are relying on the published documents that the state puts out and on what the statute says and on the information they've collected during the audit. And then typically an appeal is disputing some of the facts that the auditors have found. Maybe they had incomplete information when they were there.
Representative. Well,
Madam Chair, Representative Kresha, I think that you should advise them to have a before and after CD and then send that to Mr. Melcher.
I think that's good advice, Representative Murphy. Representative Kresha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Murphy, I love that. That's a great suggestion. Mr. Melcher, there's two sticky points here, right? The perceived vagueness of the core curriculum. The other issue we have here is the location. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Kresha, the statute is very clear, 126C19, that public school programs that provide instruction in core curriculum may be provided to shared time pupils only at a public school building. So there's a question of fact as to whether those programs were provided at a public school building. I quickly read through the audit report before it went out yesterday, and I don't recall seeing anything about the band program being at the public school. I think the auditors are assuming it was at the private school. So that's a question of fact that I think could be cleared up on the appeal.
And so,
Representative Kresha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so as I think this, I mean, in outstate Minnesota, in our many of our situations, school districts rent gyms for gym space. They find creative ways to use the space that we have available. What I'm looking for here is, and I'm sure they'll work through whatever fines or whatever the audit will be, but I know one of the things they're asking for is planning purposes. They want to continue to do what has worked. And I'll say that again, they want to continue to do what has worked for the kids. And so what I'm, you know, could they rent the gym for $1 a day? You know, are there creative ways that they can get so that this still works? You know, we do pilot programs all around the state all the time. And I realize on one hand this is a special exception, but then I look at the list and we have three pages of schools that are trying to be creative with shared time. And what I'm looking for is, what are our alternatives? I don't believe the alternative should just be, this is how it has to be. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for, what could it be to work for these kids and these teachers?
Mr. Madam Chair and Representative Kreischer, we've had the issue come up before about public schools renting space at private school locations and providing programs there. And our student accounting manual specifically says that a public school can rent space in a private school if it needs the space for its public school students. So in other words, if they were going to provide physical education at the private school because they didn't have enough gym space at the public school, and they were going to send some public school kids over there to do that, and the private school kids participated in that, that would probably be okay, and that would be considered shared time. But if the public school is renting space in the private school for the sole purpose of providing instruction to the private school kids, in the past we've said, no, that's just a work around the law, and that's really space in the private school. It's not a public school program. It's a program that's specifically for the private school kids. And so our student accounting manual would say that would not be an allowable solution, unless the law were to change to say that that was allowable.
Representative Kreischer.
What if we were to include a simple clause that says, unless there's a memorandum of understanding between the two entities that is accepted by the commissioner?
Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Kreischer.
The correct answer is yes, but go ahead.
If you were to do that, we would probably have some fiscal impact.
Okay.
Because probably any, and you've got a very good example here of a public school and a private school that are working very well together. That's not always the case, I know. But I think in many school districts it is the case that they want to work together and be cooperative. So I think what you've got is a situation where if the rules are loosened up, and the department would certainly want everyone to know about that, so we have a level playing field for all, my guess is that it wouldn't just be this school that would want to take advantage of that. It would be others, and so there would be a cost to the state to carry that.
Representative Kreischer.
And Mr. Miller, walk me through what that. I'm not sure I understand what the cost would be. Is it because suddenly all these schools in these lists would be moving teachers? Where do you anticipate that fiscal note?
Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Kreischer, I think the list that you have is the list of the shared time average daily membership that we currently have. And so what you've got on that list is for private school, for the shared time, the special education column, the students with IEPs, currently the state law and federal law allows the shared time program to be provided either at the public school, a neutral site, or the private school. So there's no issue there with those students. But in the column, and I'm not sure, I haven't got the exact report in front of you, if there's a column there for the non-special education students, then for those students, we're assuming that all of those services are being provided at the public school building right now. So if the state were to say, let's say we passed a law that says that the services can be provided at the private school building as long as there's an agreement between the public school and the private school to do that, then I think over time we would see more and more school districts that, you know, they want to be cooperative with their private school. They may be providing the physical education teacher for more and more private school programs at the private school. But we're not paying for any of that right now. We happened to find out about that in this one school because of the audit. And, you know, quite frankly, we audit 25 schools a year. It's basically a once every 20 years kind of a deal because we have 500 entities we have to audit. So, you know, chances are you can be doing this for a long time before the state ever finds out about it. So I'm not going to say that Pierce was the only school in this situation, but our assumption is that these schools that are providing the shared time instruction that's not special ed, that they're providing that at a public school site consistent with what our MARS guidelines were. So if we were to open it up and say, well, anytime you have an agreement between the schools to do this, then that opens up the possibility that some schools that aren't doing it right now will will start doing it. So right now, if the private school calls the district on the phone and they say, gee, can you provide a physical education teacher for us? We've got a gym space available. The public school administrator will probably say, gee, I'd like to, but the law won't let me do that, and I can't get reimbursed for that teacher. If the law were to change to say, if you have an agreement, that public school superintendent can no longer say that, they'll say, well, gee, give me time to hire a gym teacher, or maybe we'll hire yours, and we'll provide that service, and then the state will pay the general education formula allowance times the number of hours the kids were there. And over time, it's not going to all happen at once, but over time there will be a cost, and it will get larger as more school districts adopt that practice.
Representative Crescia.
And thank you, Madam Chair. But as I understand it, if those students were to pick up and go to the school district anyway, you're paying that revenue. Okay. So the fiscal note that you're talking about is the fiscal note of us paying for more students going to private school. Under this scenario, we're paying a sliver of that cost because it's just their time. But if these kids were just to uproot and move over, we'd have the full FTE.
Mr. Melcher.
Which would be a larger fiscal note.
Representative Precia, we have a very small number of students in the program now. You can see the state total average daily membership is 526, but if you exclude the special ed, it's only 351 full-time equivalents in the entire state. That's not very much. And I think probably one of the reasons for that is there are real barriers. And you can, from listening to the testimony here, you can see what some of the barriers are. In their case, it's only two blocks, right? But still, it's not that efficient to put coats on the kindergartners, get a bus running, drive them over there two blocks, drop them off, pick them up. That's a difficult challenge. I think the public schools would be much more likely to use this service if it could be at the private school rather than at the public school. So right now, I guess there's a barrier to doing this. It probably tends to be much more limited, and they really have to want it badly enough to be willing to transport their kid over to the public school in order to get the program. But if you make the program available to private school, then, and it also depends on, you know, how broad you open it up. Is it only physical education? Is it physical education and music? Is it all elective courses that aren't required for graduation? You know, the broader you open it up and the easier you make those programs accessible, then the more hours you're likely to pay for it. That's all I'm saying. And I don't have a fiscal note prepared on exactly what it would be. I'm just saying there would be a significant cost, and it would vary depending on how broadly you defined services that were allowable at the private school.
Representative Grisha. And Mr. Melcher, and is it allowable, or does it happen that you're aware of where a private school will contract for maybe part of a teacher's time to come over in a more formal arrangement where they're, I guess, reimbursing the public school that they have a shared time revenue arrangement with, or is the shared time revenue just mean that it's just an arrangement through their state funding and that doesn't enter into the picture?
Madam Chair, the shared time program is just where the state is paying on a part-time basis for students who primarily attend public schools, but for part of the day they are private schools, but for part of the day they attend a public school. So what we're really saying is these students are part-time private school kids and part-time public school kids, and we're paying for the part of the day that they're in the public school. Now, I know in the case of special education, there's a lot of, you know, public school teachers that provide services in private school settings. I'm not sure, maybe the School Board Association or the Superintendents Association might have a better handle on whether school districts contract. You know, school districts could, you know, let's say you've got a band teacher and he's the only band teacher in town, right? So, you know, theoretically, I suppose a school district could contract for part of that person's time, but it would be the private school paying for it, not the state of Minnesota paying for the bill.
Thank you. Representative Detmer.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mine is kind of like on your question was, let's say you have a, Mr. Melcher, you have a private school and a public school, and what if the public school teacher is a half-time teacher at the public school, and then goes the next part of the day as a half-time teacher at the private school? Does that work? I was just doing some brainstorming here, so.
Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Detmer, again, I'm not an expert on contract law, and you know, possibly the school boards or the school districts might have a better handle on that, but certainly, let's say that a school district hired a teacher as a 0.5 teacher, mm-hmm. and the person's looking for another job. He wants to be employed full-time, right? Not ready to retire. The private school in town needs a half-time teacher. Certainly, a teacher could hold a contract with the public school and a contract with the private school, but the state wouldn't be paying for the contract with the private school. Here, we have a situation where the shared time aide is paying the salary of the teacher for the time that they're teaching physical education in the private school. And in our read of the law, that's not a law.
Thank you. Other questions? And I don't know, since we invoked your names, if any of MSBA or AMSD, if anyone's here and wants to comment, don't have to. No. He's got it. Okay. And all right, so did our superintendents have anything else you wanted to add to the discussion?
No.
I'll need you to come down to the testifier table. Mr. Weber.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to come back. I think that what we've heard is what's not appealable is their definition of core curriculum. And that, to me, is sort of, I mean, I can see where we say going forward, okay, what are we going to do next year? Well, they're going to take money away for what we've already done on a law that's not well-defined, just because we happen to be one of them that got audited. And I feel like what we're hearing is I can appeal whether or not they were in the public school or not, but I can't appeal that who knew band lessons were core curriculum. They're not letting me appeal that. And we're sitting here wondering, we don't know, none of us here can say, well, for sure that's core curriculum. So how were we supposed to know that that was core curriculum and then get penalized from years back going forward? As opposed to saying, okay, starting next year, you need to build a different schedule. You know, so I feel like that's not talked about. It's not an option for me to say, wait a minute here, it's a poorly defined statute, there's never been any training on it, and you're taking money from me.
Mr. Melcher?
Madam Chair, I did speak to that issue briefly earlier. I'd just like to repeat that. What I suggested was that typically schools when they do an appeal, they're appealing, you know, findings of fact. I did say that a school district could include in their appeal other issues, such as they feel like the auditors and the student accounting manual are not properly interpreting the statute, and the commissioner could certainly make a decision to change the student accounting manual. It would be probably something that would be bigger and more difficult for the commissioner to do than the typical thing, which would be the students are actually in the public school part of the day. But I wouldn't want to be on record as saying the district couldn't appeal that. They could certainly appeal that. It would be a bigger issue for the commissioner to resolve than simply whether to approve factual information that the kids were in fact in public school for part of the day.
Thank you. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe I'll ask Dr. Melcher, but Superintendent certainly chip in. What's the dollar amount we're talking about? And I guess from what I thought I understood the superintendent to say, it's not just that the department is dealing with this year, it's that you're going back and collecting past monies too. And I'm not sure I understood it. So.
Dr. Melton.
Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, the audit, and I'm trying to remember if it was fiscal 14 or fiscal 15. Usually we're auditing, you know, a ways back. So it's one of those 2 years, and I don't recall which of the two. So the audit findings are just dealing with the 1 year. And so I believe it's $52,000. That was the amount that was associated with the shared time finding as presented by the auditors, subject to review. But certainly going forward, we would be advising the district that they shouldn't be reporting those students as they have in the past. So, you know, as they're looking at their budget for this year, we would probably be expecting that they wouldn't be reporting those. You know, if we see, you know, I think it was about 10 shared time students they had on a full-time equivalent basis. If we see 10 full-time equivalent shared time students again. We're probably not sending the auditors out, but we might send them an email saying, gee, did you change the program? Are those kids now coming over to the public school for Phi Ed? Because we've already had a ruling that you can't be doing this other. That would probably be, I think, what he's alluding to, that it's probably not just costing him the $52,000 for last year, but they're halfway through this year, and certainly they've incurred that expense already.
Mr. Weber?
And I certainly have my half-time Phi Ed teacher that I can't recoup my money from for the year that we're in right now. So I guess I feel like, you know, our band lessons core curriculum, Minnesota doesn't have Phi Ed standards. I mean, yes, we can say we're defining core curriculum this way now, but to say we're going to take money from you for every year since the audit for something that's not defined, I think is unfair.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Melcher, do we distinguish between elementary and secondary when it comes to core curriculum? For example, I know elementaries that cannot offer music or do not offer music. I'm not sure it's everyday Phi Ed either. Sometimes it's maybe once a week. So wouldn't that play into this interpretation as well? Because the high school is different. Credits must be earned in Minnesota to graduate. Mm-hmm. But at the elementary level, I think there's some ambiguity here about, you know, how you rule on what is it that we require and what we don't require.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, I think what our student accounting manual would say, if it's an activity that occurs during the regular core school day, and it's something that's available to the students as part of the curriculum that's offered by the school during the day, that's considered core curriculum. If they come in early before school starts to take a band lesson, that's not core curriculum.
Right.
Well, Madam Chair and Superintendent Weber, you could have the children from Holy Trinity run or bounce the basketball or throw the football or skip or hop over to the public, and you'd be just fine.
Correct. And so for 2016-17, we'll have to work something out. But they're penalizing me for other years.
All right. Any other questions from committee members? Mr. Krisha, any final comments? So you brought this to the committee's attention.
Yeah, and so I just want to thank the committee and the chair. I mean, I know it's a bit of a court of law here, but it's an issue that I didn't know much about, and I don't know that we all did, and so I'm glad we've been able to illuminate it. And, I will work in the future, because I looked at this list to see if there is a creative way to help some of these schools, because when you get into the outer state Minnesota, we're just trying to, I mean, I think what you've clearly heard is a superintendent from a public school and a administrator from a private school just trying to make it work for the kids. And I don't think that's a bad thing. And we'll look to see if we can find a solution.
Right. I mean, the reason it's only 10 FTE is because we're not in it for money. You know?
So. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Dr. Melcher, thanks for coming down and responding to our questions. And thank you. I appreciate the chance to explore the topic. So. All right, and we have, next we're going to have a presentation on the World's Best Workforce Report, and we have members from the department who are here. Welcome. All right, and Mr. Uni, we would be remiss, although you did not bring him along today. I hope you will someday, but I and the committee wish you the best on the birth of your son, right, baby, first baby, and so we're all very, very pleased and happy for you, so if you get a chance, please bring him by. The chair does appreciate it when people do that, so thank you. All right. All right, well, welcome, and please go ahead and state your name for the record, and we look forward to your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the invitation. My name is Steve Dibb. I serve as Deputy Commissioner of Education, and with me today I have Stephanie Graff, who is our Chief Accountability Officer as well, And we look forward to an opportunity just sharing a little bit more information around the world's best workforce legislation and give you an update. And out of respect for your time, we have just a short presentation that we'll run through, and then have some time after that for questions if you wish, if that pleases you.
Very well. Thank you.
So, again, the world's best workforce legislation passed in 2013. We've had a couple of small modifications over the last couple of years, but again, it charges school districts with creating a long-term strategic plan to reach five world's best workforce goals. And these goals, going from students ready for kindergarten to students exiting K-12 school career and college ready. And again, it includes all public schools, districts, and charter schools. The process, very quickly, the school boards, again, are charged with this responsibility of producing that comprehensive long-term plan. And the plan, again, and one of the misconceptions that we've been working with over the years, and I think we've got it pretty well straightened out in our school districts, is that the plan is not submitted to the Department of Education. The plan is the community's plan. It's put on the school district's website and is accessible there if anyone wants to take a look at that. They are the year after a plan is put into place, required in the fall to produce an annual report. Basically, the annual report is reflecting on the previous year and you know, what were their goals, what strategies were put into place, and then what did they realize in terms of their student outcomes. So it is a one-year strategic plan. Every year, new goals. Every year, new strategies, using data to really drive improvement in the district. And again, that is not submitted to the Department of Ed, but again, posted on the website as a report to the community each year. They also, under legislation, are to have an annual meeting with their community to talk about planning for the next year, reflecting on the past year, and that happens in a variety of modalities across the state. I've had superintendents tell me that they will bring folks into an auditorium setting similar to this with clicker technology and asking questions and getting feedback responses from larger groups of people, to having them come in cafeteria tables and doing kind of jigsaw strategies around each of the goals. You name it, our superintendents have been very creative in getting that feedback from their communities and engaging communities in their planning. And then finally, after that, in the last part of the cycle of any annual plan is that after they've developed that report, they then send a summary of that report to the Department of Education. And that summary basically covers, again, reflecting on the previous year, and it talks about what were your goals, what were your strategies, what were your outcomes. Very simply, give us a kind of a thermostat, if you will, of how you did last year in your district with the student achievement goals under World's Best Workforce. In 2015, a small piece was put into legislation that required the Department of Education to also create a report to the legislature, which was submitted about 2 months ago, a month and a half ago or so. And that is kind of what we are reporting on today. Hopefully you've all had a chance to read through that. One of the things that was asked in that request is that we also highlight how many school districts or charter schools had not handed in that summary the first year, just because of probably communication, that lack thereof, understanding of the legislation. We didn't get all of them in. This year we set a target. We communicated very clearly and often, and our superintendents and school districts and school boards responded very well, and we just only have a handful of districts that and charter schools that have yet to this day. I think 11 is the number we have at this point that we do not have a summary from. In terms of that outreach I mentioned, right from the get-go in 2013, we hit the road going around the state talking about this new piece of legislation, which is pretty broad, very sweeping legislation that impacted planning of school districts. And so we wanted to make sure we got out face-to-face with them. So from October 2013 to February 2014, we put on a fair share of miles on state cars and talked to over 800 participants across the state, mainly superintendents, school board members, and others. We have presented at MSBA conferences, MREA, MASSP, the Principals Association, Title I Conference, AMSD, Summer Superintendents Conferences for the last several years. Last year, the Summer Superintendents Conference in August was all about World's Best Workforce and the plan that, you know, helping superintendents and districts plan their strategies for the next year. We've had an ongoing basis. You're kind of pretty much at the table here looking at the World's Best Workforce team at MDE, and so we've handled literally hundreds of one-on-one technical calls from superintendents and school board members as well. Once again, this past November, the commissioner loaded up the car, and we did the circuit around the state again and talked to superintendents, giving them update. Some of the slides that you see today, we expanded on quite a bit in those 1 to 2 hour meetings. And then we've had, I think this is the third or fourth legislative hearing we've already had this spring on this. So, again, we love every opportunity to talk about this and talk about the great work that districts are doing. Last year, districts did not use the standard format. We said, you know, let's show us your goals, your strategies, and outcomes, and we want to review those and give feedback for you as well as the districts. And we ended up with summaries that, if you can call them summaries, that I think the largest was 76 pages long of data and detail and so forth and so on. And we said, you know, if we're going to be able to review these and be able to give clear feedback to districts about, again, just the points of the World's Best Workforce legislation, we want to make sure that we're comparing apples to apples here. So MDE created a template and a rubric for districts to follow for the summaries. We've gotten much better feedback on that from school districts. Just tell us what to fill out and what to submit. And they did a nice job of those summaries. They were due on December 1st, like I said. We had a vast majority of the summaries in on December 1st, right at 4:59. I know my emails were still clicking. And we did have a few that came in between December 1st and actually in March now. We have a couple more that came in. We had another wave that came in December and January. And then we rounded up about 43 staff members from the Department of Education that work in various programs, from title programs to special ed programs, our content specialists, our career and college ready specialists, from all the divisions to sit down with Ms. Graff and go through that rubric and a training about how to review these. We did iterative reliability training with them so that every summary was reviewed first by a team of two. Those results and that summary was then handed to another team of two, and they went through and then they met to come to consensus on the feedback that they would give to the districts. And the feedback, we want it to be supportive in nature. We want to let them know that this is good information that you provided, and maybe, you know, this would also be additional good information to provide in your plan and your report for next year. And that feedback was just sent out to districts that made the December deadline just earlier this month. There was that group that came in after December 1st, about 28 of them, 26, something like that, and we are just finishing, our team is just finishing the review of those, and we'll be getting that feedback to superintendents, so again, they can use that in the development of their plan for next year. In the next slide, the measures, you know, there's been a lot of conversation around student data and measures, and how do you measure success, and how we close the achievement gap, and all those things around those five goals. And within the legislation, it gives districts a lot of flexibility in how they set their goals. So to say, how are all districts doing in, you know, raising reading levels for fifth graders? We have one set of data for that. We have a reading assessment that we give, but they may not set their goals on that reading assessment. They may set it on any number of diagnostic reading assessments that they use locally, or even develop locally from grade level to another. And so those goals really vary from place to place. So I'll turn it over to Ms. Graff and have her talk a little bit about how we work with districts to work and their SMART goals and give them some data in order to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. So as Steve talked about, that's really what we're seeing around the goal setting, the reporting of the results, and the progress in the five areas of World's Best Workforce. We're seeing a variety of the types of measures and assessments and indicators that districts are using, which is great because districts have state-level measures that are available to them, you know, mainly our graduation rates and our MCA assessment results and some other indicators as well. But they also have really, really meaningful local data that they're using to set their goals and they're using to talk with their stakeholders about their progress on their results and set benchmarks over time in the short term and long term as well. What we are seeing is that, as the commissioner would say, I think districts are maturing in their goal setting, and we're seeing some districts set very, very rigorous yet attainable and what we're calling kind of SMART goals, specific and time-based, and we're seeing other districts that really have maybe some work to do and where we can really provide and target some of our support around goal setting to make sure that these are goals that where you really can measure progress, right, and that the measures that we're using really are valid and reliable. So I would say the quality and the rigor of the goals that we're seeing in the summaries really do vary across the state, as well as the types of assessments and the metrics that that districts are using, and we are providing a lot of support around SMART goals and how to set SMART goals. Steve did talk about the regional meetings that we had last fall with the commissioner. I know some of you were able to attend some of those in as we kind of toured the state, and at that time we talked a bit about SMART goals and the need to ensure that our goals are based on, you know, a point in time, and that they're specific and that we can measure them and that we can really communicate progress with our goals. So I think this gives just sort of some good examples about the types of goals, the variety of goals that we're seeing in our summaries. And you're seeing some, for example, kindergarten readiness, so increased participation in ECFE learning opportunities. It's quantified by 2% between 2014 and 2015. Or you're seeing maybe looser goals where we might be able to strengthen things like we will use data to identify instructional needs of all students. So we're trying to work towards getting that to be a little bit more measurable and a little bit more specific. The use of MMR data around achievement gap, some focus on student groups will raise achievement for Native American students. So we're seeing quite the variety in the types of goals, and I think this gives some good examples of the sorts of measures that we're seeing across the state.
Ms. Graff, if I can interrupt for
sure.
Just 1 second in that. So as you're giving guidance to districts on their goals and that, I mean, are you being tough on the districts who really aren't stretching much in their goals? I'm just looking at the one on third grade reading, you know, from 76.2% to 77%. Is that the kind of stretch we're looking for?
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. That's exactly the type of feedback that we're providing. That Steve mentioned, we had, we've really shifted to a kind of a more rigorous and even kind of qualitative review process, and those are the types of comments that MDE staff are providing to say, that doesn't seem so rigorous there to have a 0.8% increase. That's not going to get us to our 50% gap closure goal by 2017. And that's not the message that we want to send to our communities, or certainly not to our students as well. And so that is exactly the type of feedback that we're providing, both upfront before they submit, as well as on the back end after we go through our review.
And Madam Chair, in response to that, we developed our own set of data for school districts based on state level data that she can run through with you right now. And in that data, and these are available online for each of your regions in the state of Minnesota, so you can see how your school districts are doing in terms of our state level data. Again, they don't need to use it, but it's what we measure. And in there, it will actually give the target that they need to reach in 2017 to realize their achievement gap goal or their graduation goal by 2020. And so again, if you set this goal and you need to go there, it's in black and white for them in these data profiles. So I'll let Stephanie talk about that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that's right. So
I opened up the box now, so I have to let members ask a question on this line. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just out of curiosity, what enforcement measures do you have in the department to, if you want the district to change? How can you force them to change?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Newton, the legislation grants very little authority to the agency to reach out and intervene or hold them responsible in any way. So what we'd like to do is be able to provide technical assistance and support, and I think this has been a really positively received method. And also by sharing these profile reports where you open up your regions and you see your district and all the other districts in the area, there's kind of a sense of accountability to your other fellow district leaders and other school districts to do a better job and move along. And then, like I said, if you need help with that, we will make sure that you have the technical assistance to write the goals, understand the data. I think that's one of the areas, Representative Newton, that we've seen that we could do even more support in helping districts and staff members in schools understand what their data is saying and then be able to put those measures out there and help them really establish good goals. But again, our intent is to provide that technical assistance when we see that, and congratulate those who are making the progress that we hope to see on these goals.
Madam Chair, just a comment is that my fear is that what we'll do is just adjust and move up a few years and still not reach the goals, and we'll keep changing the time frame that we allow the schools to comply without some sort of an enforcement measure.
There is, Madam Chair, if I may,
yep.
And Representative Newton, there is at the end of the legislation, gives the commissioner authority after the third year, and we are entering into the third year of working with school districts and looking at their measures, to determine that if a district is not making, and I quote from the legislation, adequate progress toward improving teaching and learning, by looking at their goals and their results, that the commissioner has the ability to intervene by sitting down and collaborating with districts and saying, you set your goals, they didn't move very far, so what is it that you're going to need to move on, because the rest of the districts are moving on and they're closing gaps, they're increasing graduation, they're getting more kids ready for kindergarten, and be able to recommend the use of general ed funding up to 2% to kind of repurpose that funding for professional development, for new strategies. And maybe this reading program that we've been doing for many years hasn't gotten the results we want. Well, what else is there that we could take a look at? And then the next bullet in the legislation after that is that Department of Education will provide technical assistance strategies and best practices to school districts so that they can, in the next three-year round, that they can realize the growth. So it's an authority given to the commissioner to intervene from the standpoint of sitting down and having these collaborative conversations about, here's your data, it didn't move, how do we move your kids and really close those achievement gaps and raise graduation rates, and maybe let's take a look at the creative, and this is as close as I'll get to school financing, Madam Chair, is to use some of these funds to repurpose them and look at how are we spending those resources on teaching and learning, and is there a better way to do that based on best practices from things like our reward schools and other schools and districts that are really moving the needle on this.
Thank you. All right. Please continue, Ms. Graff.
Okay. So on an annual basis, we started this last year and we will continue to do so. MDE has provided all districts and charter schools in the state with a World's Best Workforce data profile. And what we've really done is we've packaged some of the key state indicators into one data profile that is really focused on the five areas of the World's Best Workforce. We have 9 data profiles that we developed and will continue, as I said, to provide these on an annual basis every fall, usually early fall. They were released early October, right before we were heading on the road to do some of the regional meetings with superintendents. And there are 9 regions, and the 9 regions are on the following slide, breaking up the state. And you can also find the link here where you can see the data profiles on our website. So these data profiles are going to provide district-level indicators for each of the five areas of World's Best Workforce, as well as regional performance. So what you can do, or what districts can do, is they can look at how they're doing for third grade reading, as an example, compared to all districts within their region, as well as compared to the region as a whole. And so it's a really good way to shed light on where there are successes, to, begin to facilitate some really good conversations and sharing of practices across districts to really know where are we seeing, really great achievement or closure of achievement gaps for particular student groups, and go and see what is that third grade reading teacher doing, or, you know, what kind of practices do they have in place. So it's really facilitated, I think, the start of some really good conversations of sharing on a regional basis. We broke these up by EXU region, and so you can see the two links provided there with the data profiles, as well as the EXU regions and what those kind of mean. Just because of limited time today, we're not providing a lot of the data. We've done that at a couple of the past hearings, but I just wanted to say that we're always happy to follow up with more information about the data, or if you'd like a walkthrough of the data profiles. They're complex, but I'm always happy to provide that sort of assistance. So while it's not in this presentation today, I just want you to know that I'm happy to have those discussions.
All right, thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Graff, I guess we haven't yet on this page that you're going to now. Would you expound a little bit on close the achievement gap among all groups? Because what I hear is that the MMR, and I think we're in a transition now to reform or change that, but I think these other groups, districts understand the data and have some idea as to how they can improve learning and growth, but in the MMR, I think there still continues to be confusion out there about, well, what do we do now? That's what they say to me. So if you could expound a little bit on that as you walk us through these profiles.
Sure, Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, I'd be happy to just start with the achievement gap measure, and then I'll walk through each of these indicators. So when we're looking at the achievement gap measure within the context of the data profiles as well in the context of the MMR, and I will say we were very intentional about using a consistent measure here. It's the same as what we've been providing for multiple years. I think this is the fourth year the commissioner has provided this achievement gap data to districts. And so what it allows districts to do is really see for, and it's inclusive of all grades in the district, is to see for every single student group, they have to have at least 20 students in a student group for that group to count, is that student group reaching their annual kind of established target? And so within the 2015 data profiles, we're looking at the performance for Hispanic students, for example, in the district, and whether the Hispanic student group is kind of on track to the 2017 goal, and they would be considered on track if they met their 2015 target. And so districts can really see how the incremental increases on an annual basis of these targets. So they would be able to go back and say, our targets for our Hispanic student group, they've gone up 3 points every year. And so we know we need to keep up with that 3-point increase every single year for Hispanic students. So it allows them to track over time, and then it allows them to see where they are kind of, you know, in a given year towards that 2017 gap closure goal. And so that's really the achievement gap measure that we're using. So we look at both math and reading, and it includes all grades. And this did, you know, come from federal accountability. And again, in an effort to really stay consistent and have some alignment across state and federal kind of systems, we used that same measure here. And as I said, superintendents were very, very familiar with this measure.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then, why are they confused about the data that goes along with the MMR and this? Because that seems to be where the rubber meets the road, is that the MMR is throwing them off because they understand this, but then the other is confusing.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, thank you. I think I understand your question. So when we look at the achievement gap measure used here in the World's Best Workforce Data Profiles, it's actually the same as the proficiency measure of MMR. We have another growth gap measure, and I don't want to get too technical or into the weeds, but that's called our achievement gap reduction domain of the MMR, and that is a different measure, and it's focused on student growth and looking at growth gaps using growth Z-scores. And so this measure right here is actually, again, that proficiency part of the MMR. And so you may be referring to, Representative Erickson, that achievement gap reduction domain, which is very separate from this. Thank you, Madam Chair. So we do have for the other areas, for kindergarten readiness, we don't have one, as you may know, we don't have one state assessment or state indicator that all, you know, is inclusive of all students. Through our Race to the Top efforts, we have developed some valid and reliable tools at the state level to assess students at the entrance of kindergarten. But we don't have all that data collected right now at the state. We're hoping to move in that direction, but districts are using their own local measures right now for kindergarten readiness. As far as third grade reading, we're looking really at third grade reading proficiency, and we're looking at where did the district start, where's the district going in 2017, and then where is the district now in 2015. And then also including grade 4 reading growth scores, our literacy incentive aid is inclusive of both third grade proficiency as well as fourth grade growth, and so we wanted to make sure that we were including not just where are the students in third grade, but what kind of acceleration are we seeing in third grade and fourth grade in reading as well. For all students career and college ready, we really have a host of indicators that we're seeing districts use, whether that's ACT, which we know now in Minnesota is not inclusive of all students, maybe SLED's data looking at enrollment in post-secondary and two-year and four-year colleges, need for remediation. Maybe they're looking at programming in high school, so maybe taking kind of an equity lens and seeing participation in AP and IB or CTE. There are a lot of measures districts are using. What we landed on here for our data profiles was eighth grade math for a couple different reasons. First, it's inclusive of all, and we wanted to make sure that our indicators that we're using here in our state profiles include all students and not just a subset of students. Secondly, we know that our 8th grade math MCA is a strong predictor of performance on the ACT, and we've run those predictability studies. And so if we're thinking about college and career readiness, 8th grade math proficiency on our state assessment would be a strong indicator to use there. Also thinking about 8th grade math potentially being kind of a gateway to high school programming and opportunities and being very actionable for districts, looking just as they, you know, are finishing their middle school years and entering high school as well. So for 8th grade math, we're looking at percent proficient and, again, kind of giving a where did they start, sort of where's the end goal in 2017, and then where are they today. And then lastly, graduation rates. And since we released these data profiles, we've had new graduation rates, but in the data profiles that we issued last fall, we included 2014 graduation rates by student group, and we do have a 90% graduation rate goal by the year 2020 with no student group below 85%, and so we've provided that information where districts are towards reaching that 2020 goal.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we'll finish up with one more slide here, but I think it merits notice again to remind you that these data profiles were created by the Department of Education to help inform school districts about what state-level data we have. But again, they don't need to use this data in setting their goals. We've had a number of districts that set different types of achievement gap goals. It could be, I think there's one in about graduation rates and gap, and or they use a different form of assessment, and again, keeping track of their student groups. We are providing this through our state accountability system. Like Stephanie said, this from our federal, the third grade, eighth grade, and the achievement gap closure is from our federal accountability system. And then we offer up, again, the early readiness assessments that our early learning division has tested, piloted, and now being released. And then, you know, there's conversations around what is career and college ready and what are all the different things that could be used to measure that. And that those conversations around those metrics continue. But this was to be provided to them for their information, kind of give them some guidance on those SMART goals as well. They could use this information or they could do this. So, again, they were able to take that achievement gap data, and in those profiles, if you look, it'll tell them what their proficiency target is in 2015, where it needs to be in 2017 and what they achieved in 2015, and then that translates into the number of students. If you had six more students that were proficient on that reading test, you would have met your target. And so we can give them a growth projection for the following year as well. So, again, I think a lot of it is about educating districts on what data is out there, how they can use that data to put it into real students. And I think that's a challenge we still have, Representative Erickson, and I appreciate your calling that out to us, that there's still a lot of confusion there, and that's what one thing that we hope to remedy. Speaking of federal accountability systems, we have an opportunity now to build a comprehensive accountability system and support system around common goals. And with the passage of the Every Student Succeeds Act in December, the agency is now engaged, and we'll be starting in the next week or so some community stakeholder conversations around the various components of ESSA, and it's our hope that we can align our state accountability system under World's Best Workforce and our new accountability system under ESSA, the federal accountability system, and align those so that the World's Best Workforce goals are core to our new federal accountability system. And whether we use this measure or that metric is yet to be determined. That's all going to be worked out. We submit our ESSA plan to the U.S. Department of Education in January-ish of next year. And we were just on a call with the U.S. Department of Education again today. They still don't know when even the initial guidance and regs come out. We're hoping in May, final regs in October. But during that time, we'll be meeting with stakeholders and many of you, hopefully, to talk about accountability systems and what we should measure and what it means and how we build a better support system for our school. Keeping in mind that under the federal accountability system, including ESSA, it only covers Title I schools, which in the state of Minnesota is only 800 of our 2,000 schools. So the rest of the districts have not had an accountability system until this legislation was put into place. And it takes in all districts in the state. And one part of the ESSA legislation is giving us flexibility to have districts, you know, focus more at the district level like we do with the World's Best Workforce, and have the districts work with their buildings and identify those that probably need more support than others. So, again, the conversation would be how can we blend those two accountability systems into one so superintendents and districts don't have two different systems that they're trying to operate under. So that's where we're at right now with the World's Best Workforce.
Thank you. We appreciate your presentation. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and just a huge thank you to Mr. Dibb and Ms. Graff and the department for really taking broad legislation and putting it into a format that will make it work. And, you know, I remember back in 2012 when we were talking about $1 billion Viking Stadium and that huge, huge, huge project. Well, we spend about 8 Viking Stadiums a year on education. And the fact that you're mentioning that other than those Title I schools, there was really no accountability in place. And, you know, the bottom line is to provide accountability in a results-based system for parents and for students that really can move the dial on some of this data. And I know my own superintendent says, you know, a lot of these things we've been doing already, but we never kind of put them in writing. And I think he said that's been really valuable, where they can really get to with the community and talk about strategic plans, and they're focusing on result-based and data. I mean, they're looking at things that really matter. And so I just want to congratulate also the superintendents and school boards, who I know this is a learning curve. And I appreciate your work in supporting them, moving them forward, and getting kind of a template to make this thing work. So I think what's happened so far on this is really remarkable, and we're moving in the right direction. And ultimately, the bottom line is we're going to see better results and better educated students in the long run. So thank you so much.
Other questions? I'll have one. Again, going back to, I appreciate and I think it's good that the accountability really is with with the local community and the parents sending their children to school and that. And we talked a little bit, Representative Newton brought a good question up of, you know, what is the accountability really with either with the state or the department on these. You know, as these systems become a little bit mature, the goals, and maybe refined in that, I mean, do you see something down the road from any interactions with districts at this point that there may be a need for some kind of additional teeth in the law, if you will, on goals? Or I mean, we visited with, I think it was Albert Lee Schools on some of their world's best workforce goals and how they kind of worked cooperatively between the administration and the teachers and that and the community in putting together their goals. But I'm just wondering if, you know, you may have variances in how different districts and communities approach these things. So any greater need for legislative or other intervention to make sure that we're making sure that we're being rigorous, because as we know, the demands on our students as they're entering the economy continue to escalate, and we want to make sure our students are prepared.
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. There's an old saying that you can't legislate yourself to excellence, and I think it really stands true that the magic, and many of us know, and Representative Erickson was a teacher as well, the magic happens in the classroom between the teacher and the student, and then as at the district level, the superintendent being that person responsible for all things underneath that district roof. I think we feel, the commissioner feels, and I can share that I do too, as both former educators in districts and leaders in buildings, that that we feel that our role would best serve to provide the support to districts in order to do the work to call out where, you know, what best practices are out there, what some things they could suggest changing and doing differently, getting people sitting down. I think one of the first meetings I did on the world's best workforce, they were looking for all the answers. What's the best reading program? What's the best this and best that? And I said, you know where the answers are? They're in this room. And you just have to sit down and you have to start talking about what's working for you and what's working for you and what's not working for you, and start being brave and thinking outside of the box about how you're going to move your kids who have been increasing, you know, improving by 1 or 2% every year, and how can you make those leaps to 10, 15% improvement, and we'll be there to support them. In terms of other forms of legislation and authority, I leave that up, very frankly, to you as experts in legislation. I think one of the things that both the commissioner and I feel very strongly, and Stephanie also as former educators, we want to do what makes sense to the districts, what makes sense to the classrooms, and not over-regulate and over offer too much compliance monitoring types of things. We have an awful lot of people that do compliance monitoring already for other things, and a lot of it for federal. And even our federal counterparts look at the world's best workforce and say, how do you do that? How do you get districts to move when there's no compliance there? And it's about doing what's right for kids. And when we first started the working around the world's best workforce legislation, I had superintendents say, so what's with the name, world's best workforce? And now 3 years later, in all the information you see across the media about the global economy, they're getting it. We need to make sure our students, when they're done with their high school experience, step out and they can jump anywhere they want to in a global society and be part of that economy. And that change is different, and I'll say this, it's different than when I went to high school. And it's going to be different for the kids coming up, and we need to adapt our education system and make sure that we're providing what students need to be successful, not just in school, but in society. And that's where that career and college readiness really comes into play, because we need to make sure they are not just being handed a diploma on the stage and said, good luck. We need to be able to hand them a tool of life skills that they can walk off that stage with and continue on their pathways. So we defer to you on the legislation. We would certainly love to be able to provide feedback and input if something was going to change. Right now, I think, and I Mr. Amoroso is around. I would like to, I think we can both agree that we've found a nice balance right now in the five goals of the world's best workforce. They get that. They understand what they need to do. And we're starting to see some really great things happening in our district. So let's hope that, that work can continue and that we can continue supporting districts. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. I don't see any other questions from committee members at this point. I don't know if there's anyone in the public here who wish to offer any comments on the World's Best Workforce Report. Mr. Heller, are you coming down to testify? All right. Thank you both very much, Mr. Graff, Mr. Smith. We appreciate you being here. All right, welcome. Please state your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Rick Keller, unofficially represent the twice exceptional print disabled. This is the education finance on March 22nd, 2016. I don't know if the chair would allow the Ministry of Public Education to yield the questions or maybe even get back in writing for the public so they can have that on the domain regarding this ongoing conversation as we relate to Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act. Again, I stress to add the word opportunity in 2014 for a reason, as well as adding the word opportunity in the Higher Education Act of 2008, which identifies the two types of lifelong learners. Once again, blindness and print disability. Specific question I have for the Minister of Education yield to is a common strand that's found throughout the assessment SMART Consortium. I believe they're part of the two national Race to the Top groups. One is the formative, which is the para, and then the summative is part of the SMART Consortium. Again, there are two types of assessments: independence, but you know what can do, and instructional for the classroom. So again, I have a specific question. I believe a specific strand runs through this whole process of connecting and connecting assessment as classroom and outcomes. So I wondered if the chair would have allowed the department to yield to a question.
Well, why don't you state your question, and then I'll see if someone from the department can come up and provide a response.
I provided a handout to Ms. Erickson, Ms. Carlos Marani, and yourself, and it gets into our new national metric, which is called Lexile. And there's a little triangle on there, I believe, that kind of bores down into how it relates to Universal Design for Learning. And I think Universal Design for Learning started in 1985 at Harvard or CAST, now under a new funding stream called aem.cast.org. They took new federal money starting last year because universal design is for everybody and is needed and essential in the classroom setting, for including the twice exceptional and print disabled. So the question again specifically, is there a common strand that runs through ACT, SAT, MAP Testing 3, FUPLACER, NWA, that's in the classroom. There's many assessments that have a common strand that has to do with text complexity as it relates to cognitive overload regarding these specific learners. Again, is there a common strand on a national level so people can be engaged in content based on how they acquire, enjoy, and provide the same services with ease and use in our education system? Again, specifically, the outcomes for those in the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act and those in the Higher Education Opportunity Act. Again, blindness and print disability, a functional thing that has to relate, again, how people acquire, enjoy, and are motivated, and are provided by the same public services with ease and use. Again, silent readers, oral readers, no others. It's a real simple, simple piece about being on task, being engaged with content, being able to process information in 7 seconds, which we all have for working memories on an average level, and be able to store it and retrieve and build upon it based on acquiring information. Again, a simple strand. Does it run throughout this process of all these assessments? Classroom,
All right, Mr. Heller, I'm going to ask the department's representatives if any of them has any comments on your question, since we are just about at 2:30. Mr. Uni.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the question, Mr. Heller. I don't have the information on hand about whether the common strand of tax complexity exists between the assessments that are given, including ACT, SAT, NWA, and others. I can certainly go back to the department and talk with our assessment division, and we can respond to the committee and Mr. Heller in kind in writing with the information that we have.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Uni, I'm quite sure that it exists within our state testing because I had a conversation in the last administration with Commissioner Siegert about this. And so I'm sure that that's followed through. But whether or not it is true of ACT, NWEA, SAT, et cetera, I don't know. But I was assured that that they had worked on it in the last administration and made sure that they addressed this need that Mr. Heller is always referring to. But
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I can look into that to provide those assurances and provide that information
Thank
in the follow-up as well.
If I may just speak one more piece here.
Mr. Heller, very briefly, we're at 2:30.
Recall. It's my understanding, I hope that he sends you and copies me on this and that it becomes a fully accessible document, because currently the document is not online, specifically under your committee, but you got to go up to the reference library. The other piece of this again, it's my understanding, and hopefully Adash, he didn't recognize himself, I'm not doing that for him. It's my understanding that Minnesota kind of did an alignment study with Lexile back in 2009, and it's common knowledge, because I've talked to Adash about it before. Anyhow, maybe he's forgot it. Obviously, things do happen, a lot of stuff going on here. Minnesota became the 21st state in the country to align their accountability assessments to Lexile, which was part of the diploma project, where the governors and commissioners got together with the college universities and looked at how to make the connection. Not only have common core standards, but also they have a common denominator such as metric Lexile, because the NAEP people, the National Academic Performance Education Assessment, recognizes Lexile best on informational. As we all know, we've moved that up to 70% now, informational text. The piece of this is Minnesota.
Mr. Heller, I'm sorry, but we have another committee who has this room. So
Minnesota got rid of degree of power reading, and they kind of silently accepted to move their reading level up by three grade levels. I think it's relevant to a conversation as it relates to outcomes for third graders as well as eighth graders as we move ahead to college career readiness. Hopefully, the department will get back to you in a respectful and a timely and accessible format, and perhaps it'll be a more engaged conversation. It also relates to the teacher assessments. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. And again, thanks so much to our FCCL students who are here with us today. We appreciate you being here at the committee. And with that, the Education Finance Committee is adjourned.